Welcome to Single Malt History with Gareth Russell, pouring out your serving of pure, distilled, intoxicating, and occasionally delicious history. In the mist-soaked and freezing opening weeks of 1919, a prince with no nationality arrived at Buckingham Palace. At his baptism, 32 years earlier in Switzerland, he had been christened Sixtus Ferdinand Maria Ignatius Albrecht Roberto. We'll call him Sixtus, or Prince Sixtus of Bourbon Parma, as he was quasi-officially. Sixtus and his siblings were the products of revolutions and royalty's shattered dreams. He was born in Republican Switzerland because his father was deposed from his Italian dukedom when he refused to support the country's nationalist revolution. The deposed duke was himself the great-grandson of the last Bourbon king of France, Charles X, driven into exile by the Revolution of 1830. Sixtus's mother, Maria Antonia, was a princess of Portugal, whose father, King Miguel, the absolutist, was also overthrown. So Sixtus and his siblings had known a peripatetic upbringing, moving between their homes in Italy and France, which denied the prince and his brothers the chance to serve in its army, fearful that royal presence at the front would offer inspiration to the still significant number of Frenchmen keen to see their monarchies return. If being overthrown was a family trait, Prince Sixtus could have been forgiven for thinking by about 1914 that it was a recessive gene, until it made its presence known once more in 1918. Sixtus's younger sister, Princess Zita of Bourbon-Parma, had married in 1911 Austria's Archduke Karl, who succeeded his great-uncle as Emperor of Austria and King of Hungary 5 years later in November 1916. Karl as Emperor with Zita as his Empress lasted almost exactly 2 years on the throne until they were swept away by the carnage and the chaos of the First World War. Karl, Zita and their children were still trapped in a now Republican Austria, where their lives were considered under threat from socialist paramilitary organisations keen to ensure that the Habsburgs never returned to power. To save his sister and her family, Prince Sixtus was undertaking a seemingly improbable task, if not quite a seemingly impossible one, by asking the British royal family to help get them out of Austria. This was an unlikely mission in two regards. Firstly, the British had, notoriously, only 2 years earlier, denied an asylum request for King George's cousin, the deposed Tsar Nicholas II, on the grounds that granting refuge to a fallen absolutist would be deeply unpopular with the British people. Secondly, Britain and Austria had been on opposite sides of the worst war in human history thus far for the past 4 years. The Windsors had refused to help the Tsar, despite the fact that Russia and Britain had been on the same side. So what possible chance did the deposed Habsburg Emperor stand of securing the Windsors' help? Sixtus had actually only seen his imperial sister once in the past 5 years in a set of subterfuge I was so certain I was going to get this right with my confident quasi-alliteration. Sixtus had only seen his imperial sister once in the past 5 years in a set of subterfuge-saturated circumstances, which I hope to one day focus on for an episode on this podcast. But the reason for this was that he too had fought on the opposite side to Austria. He and his younger brother, Prince Xavier, denied the chance to serve their ancestral homeland of France in its army because of their royal pedigree, petitioned Belgium's King Albert I, who granted them leave to join the Belgian armies after the German invasion of 1914. The war was over. Tearing down the Austrian and German monarchies, shaking their Bulgarian allies, and looking very much as if it was about to bury 6 centuries of the Ottoman sultans. And Sixtus hoped truly that some sense of royal solidarity would move the Windsors more than patriotic grudges, especially since news had by then seeped into Western Europe about what had happened to the ex-Tsar because he stayed in a country over which he had ceased to rule. 16 months after his monarchy's collapse, Nicholas, his Anglo-German wife Alexandra, their 4 daughters, teenage son, and 4 remaining servants, were woken up in the middle of the night, taken down to the cellar of where they had been kept under house arrest, and murdered by a firing squad drawn from members of the local Communist Party. Monarchists, who took the town where the massacre occurred only a few days later, had found bullet holes in the wall, a manicured severed finger in the nearby forest, along with various pieces of jewellery, buckles, and religious icons that they were fairly confident had belonged to the vanished Romanovs. The Soviet government insisted that the Yekaterinburg massacre had never happened, that it was all, quote, lies of the capitalist press, end quote. Yet, despite this denial, the Romanovs had disappeared, and there were clear signs of terrible violence in the last place where they had been seen alive. We know now that their bodies had been taken into a nearby forest where they were disfigured with sulfuric acid, burned, and then buried in a clearing. They were not discovered for decades, in which time rumours were able to percolate that one or more of the family might have survived. It would be several years before these rumours settled on the story that the survivor was the youngest of the Tsar's daughters, the Grand Duchess Anastasia, 17 at the time she disappeared. Yet, by the time Prince Sixtus made his mission to London in the miserable early months of 1919, the news that the entire family had likely all been murdered on the same night by their political enemies was circulating, and it urged Sixtus to approach anybody who might be able to help his sister avoid a similarly terrible fate. Although Sixtus could not have known it, the dead Romanovs had become his best allies in this quest. The decision not to offer the Tsar asylum in Britain in 1917 is, I would argue, far more understandable in context. George V is routinely damned, even today, by many observers and commenters for saying no to receiving his deposed Russian cousin, but he only did so after their cousin, the King of Norway, offered to take the Romanovs. Moving them to Norway not only made a lot more geographical sense, but as a constitutional monarch, George V was very aware of how detested Tsarism had been by many of his own people, most of whom viewed it as a repressive and regressive regime. The fact that the Romanovs weren't moved into a place of exile had more to do with internal Russian politics, as the republic that replaced them lost a little more every day to the radical left wing, who did eventually seize power from them, after which it became clear the royals' lives were in grave danger. And once that happened, once the communists took over, George V threw caution to the wind and directly intervened to get a large warship, the HMS Marlborough, sent to evacuate as many of the Romanovs out of Russia as was humanly possible. This included the Tsar's mother, sisters, brother-in-law, and numerous cousins, but by then, alas, the Tsar himself was trapped thousands of miles inland with the captors who became his killers. All of which is important extenuating circumstance, which vitally shifts our understanding of the Windsor-Romanov negotiations in 1917. However, it did little to assuage George V's guilt. By the time he received Prince Sixtus of Buckingham Palace, both King George and his wife were determined never to make the same mistake again. So, when Sixtus pointed out to them that the Romanovs' fate could soon be mirrored by the Habsburgs, he struck a nerve. What if a communist revolution succeeded in Austria as it had in Russia? Queen Mary, George V's 51-year-old wife, was present at the meeting too. Although she had been born in London, Queen Mary's late father Francis, Duke of Teck, had been born in the Austrian Empire. He had studied at the Imperial Austrian Academy of Engineers and served in the Imperial Austrian Army Corps as a young man. So Queen Mary was by no means as hostile to Central Europeans as many fellow Britons were in 1919, even after the war, and she was horrified by the downfall of the Austrian and German monarchies. After listening to Sixtus's pleas that they do something to help Empress Zita and her family, King George V said, "We will immediately do what is necessary." Negotiations initially began between the British government in London and the new Republican government in Vienna to ascertain what room for manoeuvre there was over the Emperor and Empress's safety. Part of the problem was that in the eyes of many Austrians, this new republic of theirs had no right to exist, and it was not simply diehard monarchists who felt that way, because Emperor Karl had never abdicated. At the end of the war, he had signed a temporary renunciation of his authority, in large part because the American government refused to negotiate with non-democratic heads of state in the peace talks that ended the Great War. Urged to step aside so that Austria could get the best possible deal with the Americans and their allies, the emperor had been very clear that he was not giving up the throne permanently. Understandably, the Republic of Austria now wanted him to do so. They told the British negotiators that Karl von Habsburg could remain quite safely in Austria as a private citizen if he abdicated. If he refused to abdicate, he must go into exile. As an emperor in waiting, they would not allow him or his eldest son Otto to remain in Austrian territory. If Karl both refused to abdicate and refused to leave, they would arrest him. For many Austrian monarchists, the clear preferred option was B, for Karl to leave Austria without legitimizing the Republic by abdicating. The problem was that, like Nicholas II, who had himself been hesitant to leave his beloved Russia, Emperor Karl was refusing to pack his bags. He was currently holed up with his wife and their five children at a hunting lodge in Bissig-Gänzendorf, near to Austria's border with Czechoslovakia, one of the many new nation states born from the death of his family's empire. From the perspective of the British royal family, Empress Zita's brothers and the majority of the Austrian monarchist community, Karl needed to be persuaded to leave and somehow then safely be moved across the length of Austria to Switzerland, which had granted the imperial family asylum. There were no other viable options for where to move them. Since Hungary was still legally referring to itself as a kingdom, with Emperor Karl as their King Karoli IV, and so neither the Allies nor Austrian Republicans wanted the Habsburgs going anywhere where they might return quite easily to power. Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia, having recently declared independence, wouldn't take them, and in any case there were many in Yugoslavia who thought the only good Habsburg was a dead one, a similar sentiment in Italy, which had recently fought against them in the First World War, so neutral Switzerland was the only truly viable choice about where to send them. Who to entrust with the task of both persuading the Habsburgs to refugee and arranging their means to do so? The British needed someone from what was still regarded then as the right background, who would know how to talk to the imperial family and how to deal with whatever was left of their court etiquette. They needed someone who knew to Austria its language and its layout, and someone whose bravery, reliability, and discretion were already proved. They settled on Lieutenant Colonel Edward Lyle Strutt, who emerges from this episode as a bit of a real-life Kingsman for fans of the movie. A rarity in being a Catholic member of the British landed classes, Strutt was a man of courage and reason, with flexible views on most things, except his beloved pastime of mountaineering, in which he once told a fellow climber, quite seriously, that hiring a guide before going up the peak was a betrayal of mountaineering modus operandi so abhorrent that it was quote-unquote worthy of the death penalty. As a young man, Strutt had studied at Oxford and then at the University of Innsbruck in Austria, where he subsequently went skiing and mountaineering, with the future Emperor Karl's uncle, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the prince whose murder had helped start the First World War. Strutt's love of Austria came second to his duty to his homeland. For Strutt, having previously served in the Boer War, served in the British armed forces throughout the First World War. His valour and his fluency in several languages earned Strutt the attention and appreciation of several of Britain's allies, three of whom joined Britain in decorating Strutt for bravery. These three were the governments of Belgium, Romania, and France. It is interesting that, as we shall hear, two of the women of the war years Strutt admired most were the queens of Belgium and Romania. Having received his commission personally from King George, Strutt put on hold his plans to join an expedition that aimed to climb Mount Everest and instead hand-selected a group of soldiers he trusted from the Honourable Artillery Company and set off with them for Austria. There he passed through a country that had changed drastically from the one he had known in his student days. The empire, whose centre Austria had stood at the centre of in one way or the other for nearly 800 years, had vanished in the space of a few weeks. The monarchy had gone with it, on the tacit promise of a generous peace settlement from the Allies, which the Austrians were now beginning to correctly suspect would never be fulfilled. Millions had been bereaved by the war's casualties and the economy was in tailspin. Added to his political and economic woe, the country was, like the rest of the world, in the cruel grip of a pandemic. As the Spanish influenza reached the midway point in its two-year cycle, in which it would kill about 500 million people. Strutt and his team passed through Vienna, spared bombardment but neither riots nor recession, and from there they went out into the countryside to find the Emperor at Schloss Erkutsai, a comparatively small Baroque rural hunting lodge in yellow, reached by a long tree-lined avenue and built in the 18th century for Marie Antoinette's father, the Emperor Franz Stefan. It was a picturesque, quiet part of the world, surrounded by countryside with a small Catholic church nearby. Several courtiers had joined their emperor in internal exile, where they adhered to the minutiae of court etiquette in part because that was all they had ever known, yet also to convey their view that this country of theirs was still legally a monarchy. Dressed in military uniform, Strutt was shown in for his first audience with the 31-year-old Emperor Karl, His Imperial and Royal Apostolic Majesty, the Emperor of Austria, Apostolic King of Hungary and Croatia, Slavonia and Dalmatia, as he still was to the royalist faithful. Strutt bowed, presented his credentials, and informed the Emperor that he was here as a representative of His Britannic Majesty to convey His Imperial Majesty, Her Imperial Majesty and Their Imperial Highnesses to safety in Switzerland. Luckily, Strutt recorded his experiences in his diary, an entry for which is read for us by actor Paul Storrs.
With quite a good-looking, well-bred, but weak face, the Emperor's appearance describes his character. An eminently lovable, if weak, man, who is by no means a fool, and who was ready to face his end as bravely as his ancestress, Marie Antoinette.
On the issue of flight to Switzerland, the Emperor proved himself far from weak. It was, it had been, it would remain, no. He reiterated to Strutt the standard monarchist position that the new Austrian Republic in Vienna had no right to exist, as it quite explicitly violated the terms by which he had signed his act of renunciation. The agreement had been violated by one party, it was thus null to all. Karl was, as he had always been, the rightful head of state. Under such circumstances, he could not leave Austria, since to do so would be to abandon his people and his oaths as emperor. Having gotten nowhere with the emperor, etiquette permitted that Strutt was then granted an audience with the Empress Zita, the woman whose presence had inspired this mission of his through her brother's zeal in trying to get her to safety. Strutt's words on their first meeting are again read for us by Paul Storrs.
The Empress arrived wearing her wonderful pearls, although she looked pale and ill. About medium height and with a slim figure, she looked younger than her age, 26. The first impression I had of her was of her extraordinary strength of character, softened by her own remarkable charm. Determination was written in the lines of her square little chin. Intelligence was in her vivacious brown eyes, intellect in a broad forehead half hidden by masses of dark hair. Without possessing any extraordinary claims to beauty, the Empress could always attract attention in a crowd. As I entered the room, I realized that she must share, along with Belgium's Queen Elizabeth and Queen Marie of Romania, the honour of being one of the three great royal women of the war.
For Zita, raised in a family in which the evils of the French Revolution were constantly stressed by her father's relatives, the downfall of this dynasty into which she had married bordered on the traumatic. Zita maintained that the monarchy had been tricked out of existence in Austria, that America had absolutely no right to make a regime change a prerequisite of negotiation, and that even if they had that right, Austrians had been fools to accept the condition without first securing a guarantee on what kind of treaty they would receive in recompense. She felt too, as Strutt had noticed and her husband believed, that there were far more Austrians outside Vienna who did not want to see the monarchy replaced, and that if the Habsburgs had been allowed to rally their supporters, there was no question in Zita's mind that they would still be reigning from their palaces at the Hofburg and the Schönbrunn. They had been in residence at the latter. On the days the Great War drew to a close and the Habsburg monarchy with it. During those days, Zita had watched with thinly veiled suspicion the activities of the Chancellor and the Minister of the Interior as they urged her husband to temporarily abjure the throne. The Chancellor begged the Emperor to do it to appease the Allies and the hard left wing, or as the Chancellor called them, the Red Hordes, who were threatening full revolution in Vienna. Watching these displays of fear around her, Zita felt disgusted, and with her typical sledgehammer honesty, she told the men of her feelings of disappointment and revulsion for what she saw as their weakness, remarking that she would prefer to be murdered at her husband's side than voluntarily give up the throne. She only softened her stance when she was informed it was a temporary renunciation, not a permanent abdication. But she remained suspicious. An ultra-monarchist to her core, the Empress inherently distrusted Republicans. At that time, there had come the first offer to get them out safely, in a way which would have kept their personal fortune free from confiscation by the new regime. The Swiss government and the Queen of the Netherlands had sent envoys offering safe conduct out of Austria, and their government's role as guarantors of the Habsburgs' privately held properties. Carl said he could not leave his people at a time of defeat and political chaos. Zita, who was mortified by the flight into exile of their former ally, Kaiser Wilhelm II, a man whom she had always disliked, joined her husband in his determination to stay put in Austria. Austria was one thing, but they could not, however, stay at the beautiful Schönbrunn Palace. Sometimes seen as Austria's answer to Versailles, it had been built in the 18th century on the orders of one of the Habsburgs' greatest rulers, the Empress Maria Theresa. Since Karl was no longer acting head of state, he would have to leave the Schönbrunn with his wife and children to go to his private residence at Schloss Erkutsai. Years later, Zita recalled those final few moments of living at the heart of the Habsburg monarchy. Indeed, although she could not have realised it as it was happening, she was living through the final moments of an 8-century-long story. The Empress's eyewitness testimony of the final moments of the Habsburg monarchy, extraordinary stuff, is read for us by Rebecca Lenihan, who some of you may remember from our Titanic series, in which she voiced both the Countess of Rothes and Mrs. Ida Strauss. The Empress's words on the day they departed the Schönbrunn.
The Emperor and I went with our children to the chapel, where we said a short prayer that we might one day return here. After that, we went up to the room that was called the Hall of Ceremonies, where all those who had still remained behind were gathered. We said goodbye to them and thanked them, one by one. Then we went down the stairway to the small inner courtyard below where the cars were waiting. Along the side of the arcades, drawn up in two ranks, were our cadets from the military academies, with tears in their eyes, but all still perfectly turned out and guarding us to the end. They had really lived up to the motto the Empress Maria Theresa had given them in the 18th century. Allzeit getreu, loyal forever. It was dark by now, and a misty autumn night. The Emperor and I, and all the children, except Karl Ludwig, squeezed into the back of one car with Count Hunyadi at the front. In the next car came our youngest son, Karl Ludwig, who was an infant then, and the children's nurses. We did not risk driving out the main gate in front of the palace. Instead, we continued parallel with the main palace building along the broad gravel path that leads to the eastern gate. We slipped out of this and left Vienna by a special route. Late that night, without any trouble or incidents, we arrived at Ekartsau.
Strutt realized that the months between the departure from the Schönbrunn and his arrival at Erkutsai had been immensely difficult for Zita. On the one hand, that difficulty arose from her royal pride, her sense of identity, and her firmly held political beliefs. As Strutt noted in his diary,
"The Empress feels the humiliation of losing the throne more deeply than does her husband. However, in their private lives, no more an affectionate and devoted couple that these two could possibly be found."
Their refusal to leave had also seen the Habsburgs cut off from their private bank accounts and properties as the Republic moved in an increasingly aggressive series of legally questionable moves to freeze their assets. To this day, some of those decisions are being contested in courts, although that's perhaps for another time, podcast-wise. To this financial difficulty was added a sense of isolation, as the family were engulfed by the consequences of the pandemic, which crashed over Erkutsai only a few weeks after the Habsburgs lost their throne. As Zita later told her biographer,
"Christmas of 1918 was rather a somber festival, especially as the Emperor, who was already suffering from repeated heart palpitations and overstrain, had gone down with a severe attack of the Spanish influenza 10 days before Christmas, and by Christmas Day was really very ill. All the children caught it as well, some mildly, but some severely. Karl Ludwig, for example, who was barely 18 months old then, very nearly died."
Strutt liked and admired Zita profoundly. She liked him and listened to his advice. She was grateful for King George and Queen Mary's interest in them. She had been educated at an English Catholic boarding school in the Isle of Wight. She bore no more animus to the Windsors than they did to her. Yet initially, Zita applauded her husband's refusal to go abroad, even temporarily. Strutt had already sensed, as we've seen, the spectre of Marie Antoinette hovering over the emperor in this hunting lodge built for her father. The Austrian-born Habsburg queen had been guillotined at the height of the French Revolution, and as a shameless plug, you can search earlier in this series in our back catalogue for my episode on her execution. But for the purposes of this piece of history, it's worth noting simply that the story of Marie Antoinette's bravery in the face of imprisonment and death, and what, to the eyes of monarchists, was unquestionably presented as an execution that had bordered on a martyrdom, was endlessly repeated in both the Habsburg and Bourbon families in the decades after her death. So Karl and Zita had grown up with Marie Antoinette's courage and dignity as she mounted the steps to the guillotine, being cited in their family lore as the supreme example, almost the byword, for what a good royal should do in the face of crisis, even in the face of death. But as winter gave way to spring at Erquetsay, the ghost of Marie Antoinette's bravery was being exorcised by the ghost of the Romanovs. Because it would not simply be a case of Emperor Karl being lined up against a wall to be shot as his great uncle Maximilian had when he lost the throne of Mexico. Nor would Zita be paraded through the streets to die alone like Marie Antoinette. This was 1919, not 1793. The Habsburgs would likely be herded into a room with their five children, as Nicholas II had been with his five, and butchered by the Red Guard. It would be a dereliction of Zita's duty as a mother not to think of her children's safety, considering what had happened to the Tsars. It would also, as Strutt argued, be a negation of her duties as an empress as well. If the entire immediate imperial family were wiped out by assassins, who came after them? A restored monarchy needed a clear heir, a clear king across the water. When Britain's King Charles I was beheaded in 1649, Britain's republics lasted for 11 years before the monarchy returned in part because everybody on the royalist side had agreed, and never deviated from that agreement, that the moment Charles I died, their rightful king became his eldest son, Prince Charles, Charles II, who had been successfully smuggled out of Scotland and England away from his family's enemies to exile in Europe with his mother and younger brothers, from where he returned once the political opportunity presented itself. The same was true with the French monarchy, which returned to their throne in 1814. Louis XVI was guillotined in 1793. His young son, whom royalists called Louis XVII, died in a republican prison in 1795, at which point the boy king's eldest uncle, the Count of Provence, having made it across the border out of France, became universally recognised in royalist circles and by most foreign governments as the next king. He even took the regnal name of Louis, Louis XVIII, to ostensibly honour his dead brother and nephew. That was never going to happen with the Romanovs. Nicholas II had died alongside his son Alexei within a few days of Nicholas's younger brother, the Grand Duke Michael, who was also murdered by revolutionaries. Disarray now surged through the Russian monarchist community in exile, which numbered in its millions as many fled westward to escape communism. Who was the Tsar in exile? The next in line was technically the dead Tsar's first cousin, the Grand Duke Cyril. But could it really be him, considering Cyril had committed treason, as many monarchists regarded it, by leading his troops to pledge allegiance to the Republic that had initially replaced Nicholas II? If it wasn't Cyril, maybe it should be Nicholas II's senior surviving sibling, the Grand Duchess Ksenia, evacuated to Britain, with her eldest son, Prince Andrei, as her heir. Although, in the 1790s, hadn't Tsar Paul banned the throne from being inherited by women? Maybe the Pauline succession laws should be rescinded, given the circumstances. But who had the authority to do that? Nobody but a Tsar, which brings everybody back to question A. Who is it? If Cyril's actions and Ksenia's gender disqualify them, what about other senior Romanovs? Like the former allied commander, Grand Duke Nicholas, as Tsar Nicholas III? Or Rasputin's alleged assassin, Grand Duke Dmitri, as the emperor designate? Whatever way one looked at it, the Romanovs' cause had been decimated. Firstly, by the violence and organisational skills of their enemies. Secondly, and I would argue perhaps permanently, by their own internal divisions. In a system predicated on providing stability, with a lack of internal dispute over who comes next, a lack of a clear leader, figurehead, and stay tuned coming up next heir was a near fatal weakness. In 1919, it did genuinely look as if the Republic of Austria would be an aberration in the country's history, that Austria would sooner or later be a monarchy again. And so the Habsburgs had a duty, as they saw it, to be ready for that. As Strutt put it to Zita,
"Your Majesty, a dead Habsburg is no good to anyone, whereas a live one, with a family, may yet be."
Zita, thinking of her 6-year-old son, the heir, Crown Prince Otto, his 5-year-old sister, the Archduchess Adelaide, 4-year-old Robert Felix, who had just turned 2, and the baby of the Archdukes, Carl Ludwig, as well as the centuries which had come before them, at last agreed to speak to her husband on Strutt's behalf. Carl still would not budge on the issue of abdicating, and Zita neither wanted him to nor asked that of him. Instead, she laid out the reasons why she now thought their best interest and their causes lay in departure. Carl still struggled against the idea of sneaking away, like a thief in the night, is how he put it to Strutt. Strutt promised Carl on his word as a gentleman that would not happen. A train would be assembled, they would leave in daylight, there would be no grounds for anyone ever to say the emperor had snuck away, bolted or ran, as many disaffected German monarchists were by then saying about their Kaiser's escape to the Netherlands. The day of the departure from Erkutsai was set for the 25th of March. In the liturgical calendar, it is a holy day as the Feast of the Annunciation, commemorating the biblical visit of the Archangel Gabriel to the Blessed Virgin Mary and her acceptance of her mission as the Mother of God on earth. It is a significant day in the Catholic Church's calendar, and as devout Catholics, Carl and Zita decided to hear Mass before leaving. It was a particularly emotional scene, as the Emperor, the Empress, their 5 children, and a few remaining members of their entourage left the church for the local train station, where a huge crowd had gathered. A few carriages from the imperial train had been assembled one last time, yet another testament to Strutt's negotiating skills. As the Habsburgs prepared to board, the crowd burst into a chorus of the imperial national anthem, with its music by Haydn, which modern listeners may recognise as the tune has since been reused for the German national anthem. I include a recording of the Habsburg version here, a modern recording of it, as a short clip or aperture into what the Habsburgs heard that day in Erkutsai. It's of course not an a cappella crowd, but hopefully it gives us a small sensory window into that moment at the train station.
Unser Kaiser, unser Land, Mensch.
The lyrics to that first verse in English being roughly translated as, God preserve, God protect our emperor, our country. Powerful through the support of the faith, he leads us with a wise hand. Let the crown of his fathers shield us against any foe. Austria's destiny remains intimately united with the Habsburg throne. Strutt was deeply moved by the emperor and empress's dignity that day, although slightly less so by the behaviour of the empress's Portuguese mother, the Dowager Duchess of Parma, who, coming from a family with a long history of exile, knew never to go into it empty-handed. She boarded the train wearing so much of her personal jewellery collection that Strutt thought she looked like an over-decorated Christmas tree. As the train lurched off from the station, Strutt heard a low groan from the crowd, many of whom began to wave, make the sign of the cross, and even cry as the imperial family departed. Carl, Zita, Strutt, the decked-out Duchess, and the imperial children began their journey. Emperor Carl spent what would be his last night on Austrian soil on a moving train that at 3:45 the next afternoon crossed the border with Switzerland. All Carl could manage to say at the moment they left Austria was to Strutt, after 700 years. Strutt had succeeded in his mission. The Habsburgs had been saved by the Windsors and avoided the Romanovs' tragedy. They would not, however, live to be restored, as Strutt hoped. Weakened by the pandemic, Emperor Karl died 3 years later in Portugal, aged 34, after falling ill with a secondary respiratory complaint. Zita outlived her husband by 67 years. She did not remarry. For her opposition to Nazism, she was later targeted by Hitler, with the Windsors once again stepping in to save her by evacuating her and her children to Canada during the Second World War. From there, one of her daughters moved to New York, where she became the first Archduchess to train as a welfare worker. Crown Prince Otto stayed behind in Europe to make anti-Nazi speeches and recruitment movies. After the war, the Crown Prince became one of the early supporters of what became the European Union, where, as a member of the European Parliament, His Imperial Highness once punched the Northern Irish Protestant fundamentalist politician Reverend Ian Paisley right in the face. The current head of the family is Otto's son, the Archduke Carl, named in honour of his father, who, for his Catholic piety and opposition to weapons like poison gas, was beatified by Pope John Paul II in 2004, becoming Blessed Carl of Austria. Edward Lyle Strutt did not make it up Everest, but he continued to defend the Habsburgs in print and in press, and he served as president of his beloved mountaineering Alpine Club from 1935 to 1938, and died aged 74 in 1948. Please like, review, subscribe, all good things if you enjoyed this. My thanks to Rebecca Lanahan for returning to play the Empress Zita, and Paul Storrs, who you may remember as Lawrence Beasley and John B. Thayer III in our Titanic series, for very kindly lending time and talent to the words of Lieutenant Colonel Edward Lyle Strutt. Next week, I can't wait to share this interview. I loved it. I am talking to the brilliant Kate McCaffrey as she shares with us how she uncovered codes to a secret network of sympathisers hidden in the pages of Anne Boleyn's prayer book. In the meantime, thank you and take care.